This is an ABC podcast.
A few months ago, as the coronavirus pandemic took off and social distancing became the new normal, I found myself wallowing in feelings of nostalgia. Suddenly, memories of catch-ups with friends from even just a few weeks prior took on a wistful quality, and I would scroll through my social media accounts, poring over old photos and reminiscing. I have to say, it was a pretty nice distraction from the otherwise dominant feelings of worry, boredom, and uncertainty, and it turns out that may have been an effective coping strategy. Long considered a disorder, nostalgia has now been recognized for its potential to help with anxiety and depression. But it's not just about memories. Nostalgia is a paradoxical emotional state that can be both sad and uplifting. I'm Sana Qadar, and today on All in the Mind, producer Jennifer Leake looks into the psychology and history of nostalgia. Her story begins with an iconic scene from a show that understood nostalgia beautifully, Mad Men. Here's Don Draper pitching an ad strategy for Kodak's photo slide projector.
Teddy told me that in Greek, nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. A twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. It goes backwards and forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel. It lets us travel the way a child travels. Around and around, and back home again. A place where we know we are loved.
The character and the delivery in that particular scene really evoked the strong emotion that can be associated with nostalgia.
Christine Batcho is a professor of psychology at Lemoyne University, and she's a pioneer in the research around the psychology of nostalgia. She says this 2009 episode of Mad Men ushered in a new wave of interest in nostalgia.
Prior to that, a lot of people defined nostalgia, and in fact some people still do, as more of a wistful, sentimental kind of thing, which is not all that powerful and engaging. But in that scene, you can tell that it's much more than that. It can be so intense and so powerful that it can change your mood, it can change your behaviors, it has a lot of psychological effects. Mm. It's a paradox. Since it's bittersweet, it tells us that there's a combination of two things that we don't normally think of as going together. In fact, we think of them as oppositional. But when they're blended together, there's this unique, distinctive experience or phenomenon that occurs where you can be both happy and sad at the same time.
In 2011, John McDonald started a Facebook group called Lost Brisbane, a place for people to share old photos of the city. Growing up, John's father and grandfather would tell him stories of what Brisbane used to look like, and it was the death of his father that inspired John to set up the page.
I think the thing that it did is it made me appreciate his life more. It made me look back over my dad's life and say, you know, he knew an awful lot of stuff and he saw an awful lot of things that I didn't see. He saw the war, which I didn't see. And he saw the depression, which I didn't see. And there's something to be learned from that. There's all this history there. And it's like locked away in a barrel, like a barrel of gunpowder. and I lit the fuse. And since I lit the fuse, it just exploded and it just went all around Australia. There is all this history there. And when I kicked off the Lost Brisbane page, they started to spring up all over Australia. There was Lost Sydney and Lost Melbourne and Lost Adelaide. And people, various people, used to contact me and say, oh, do you mind if I start up a page about Cairns? Or do you mind if I start up a page about Adelaide? And I said, of course. I said, this is what I want. I want people to take pride in where they live and to learn about where they live.
The river sets the tone of Brisbane. The traffic of the waterway passes homes that have a character peculiarly Queensland's. Many of them, for coolness, are lifted up on tall piles.
It captures something to see a photograph of an old building or an old house. It's like the intrigue is in what you don't see. So you see an old house, an image of a beautiful old Queenslander, for example. So it gives you the opportunity for your imagination to fill in what life must have been like for the people that lived there. I remember going down to the Gold Coast as a small child, about 10 years old, and there was no high-rise there then, spending the day walking along Southport Beach, picking up these huge shells off the beach and things like that. And I'm blessed with a very good memory, and images and things like that stay in my mind. And I can, when I close my eyes and think about those times, be back there. I can be back there, you know.
When you go back to your childhood, what is it that you feel?
In a time when the world seemed to be a much nicer place. When you go back to your childhood, you see things through innocent eyes and you see the world as a wondrous place. And I think as we become older, we get jaded by the world and we look at the world, especially the world that we live in today, and we see all the injustices in the world and we see all the things that are wrong and the mistakes that have been made and the wars and the things like that. And I think there's a part of us that longs to go back to that time within ourselves when the world was more innocent because we saw it through innocent eyes.
The term nostalgia was coined by a physician called Johannes Hofer in the 17th century. He was studying the symptoms being displayed by young Swiss mercenaries who were living away from home. These days, we'd call it depression, but Hofer saw this painful yearning for home as a medical diagnosis, which he called nostalgia.
They sometimes longed so severely for their home and their loved ones that they became physically ill. Loss of appetite, sleep disorders, even to the point where some of the journal articles from that time period cite anorexia. And I found this rather interesting in one little footnote. They described anorexia as an eating disorder characteristic of men. In fact, Hofer argued that one could become so nostalgic that one might die. The only treatment that they knew of is to send the person back home, because they found that when the person returned home, they were almost immediately cured. That was where it originated in the early years of the psychiatric and psychological literature. They were thinking of nostalgia as a form of melancholy, which is, of course, by today's definition, depression. Even in 1941, as late as that, one of the prominent psychologists of his time published an article in which he treated it as homesickness and was making recommendations for how parents could prevent it in their children and how they might treat it if their children went off to, let's say, boarding school or what have you. So really the idea that it is a beneficial experience did not come until considerably late.
Tim Wildschut is a professor of social and personality psychology at the University of Southampton. He's been researching nostalgia for over 30 years.
What became clear from our studies was that nostalgia and rumination are quite distinct. Both involve thinking about the past, and there are many different ways in which one can think about the past. One can ruminate, and one can engage in counterfactual thinking, if only things had gone differently. one can brood and think about all the ways in which one has been wronged by others. But one can also nostalgize and think about sort of the valuable, meaningful friendships, relationships, achievements one has had in the past. So it's important to distinguish between these different ways of engaging with one's past, because they are quite different.
Tim's studies have shown nostalgic people tend to be more social and more empathetic. It's also a concept that young children can easily understand.
In the UK, or I imagine in Australia, young children wouldn't spontaneously use the word nostalgia. But you can very quickly and very easily explain it to them. It only takes about 5 minutes or so, maybe less, to explain it to them. So what we do is we show them a cartoon drawing. What the cartoon drawing would show is a boy listening to the radio. The radio is playing a song and the boy has a thought bubble, which shows him sitting around the campfire with his friends playing music. And we say, okay, this boy, Daniel, hears a song. It reminds him of his time with friends. It makes him feel happy, but also a little bit sad. And he wishes he could go back and experience that again. And then we say, we call this nostalgia. How often are you nostalgic? And kids get this. So as young as 9 years old, they get this. And we can measure their levels of nostalgia proneness very reliably. And they show this same correlation with empathy that we see in adults. We sometimes have a caricature of nostalgia as being something that old people do when they, you know, look back on their lives. But I think children can be extremely nostalgic, and the children's emotional world can be so rich and vivid.
Can the way you've been brought up and sort of the temperament and environment of the home bring on kids, like make kids more likely to be nostalgic?
We did a number of studies on that. We haven't published them yet. So, you know, listener, beware. What we thought was that parents who encourage mental time travel would increase nostalgia in their children. So if parents frequently encourage their children to go beyond the here and now, for example, if the child experiences some distress, the parent might say, well, you know, think about what we did last summer, or think about what we're going to do next summer. So distract the child from the here and now by encouraging to sort of transcend space and time and go back in time or go ahead in time. We thought that that kind of parenting strategy would increase nostalgia proneness in the children, and that's essentially what we found.
Queens in New York is the worst infected district in what is now the world's worst infected city.
People come in, they get intubated, they die, the cycle repeats.
Are you overwhelmed?
Yeah, the system's overwhelmed, all over the place. My daughter's an intern in Brooklyn, first year resident. She starts the ICU today. I couldn't sleep last night.
All over the world, we're seeing the devastating impact of this invisible killer.
Life is changing in Australia as it is changing all around the world. Life is going to continue to change as we deal with the global coronavirus. This is a once in a 100-year type event.
If you've found yourself getting more nostalgic during the coronavirus lockdown, even if it was just for life a few months ago, it actually makes a lot of sense, because one of the biggest triggers for nostalgia is loss. Here's Christine Batcho again.
The yearning for the past is because you know the past is irreversible. You cannot recapture anything from your past. You can only revisit it. So now that people have been in this longer state of social distancing, it has occurred to them that life might never be the same again. And they're starting to grieve or mourn the loss of what life used to be like that they might never regain, which makes them think about it more nostalgically. And nostalgia, we saw in the research, is one of these wonderfully therapeutic experiences such that when you're lonely, it counteracts the loneliness. It makes you feel a little more like you belong, that you're connected, that you haven't really become totally disconnected with other people. And the loneliness doesn't feel as painful as it did before your nostalgic reverie. And so now with social distancing, many people have become lonely. In fact, circumstances vary greatly. Some people in their social distancing are much more alone. Or imagine if someone is in quarantine because they've been exposed to the coronavirus or even have tested positive for it. They clearly are much more alone physically than other people. And it's the nostalgia that is so comforting. In fact, many people have told me that they have taken time now to look back through their souvenirs, their old photographs. Even in terms of social media, they go back and revisit posts from a year ago, from 2 years ago, and that nostalgia helps them feel like it's not all lost, that we're still anchored in what we know, the familiar from our past.
I think we had probably all been home for a week or so, and there was sort of this period where everybody was busy getting their home life organized in isolation, and then once that was done, then it was, what do we do now?
Anna Spargo-Ryan is a writer and author, and during the lockdown with her two teenage daughters, she found herself drawn to old video games and TV shows.
The first thing was video games, I think, which, because it's an immersive sort of experience, it's very easy to use it as a distraction and sort of become consumed by it, which is exactly what I was looking for, like a way to get out of the coronavirus mindset. I mean, we were all, you know, using social media at the time when this all started happening in Australia. So, you know, the middle of March, hundreds of posts that were all talking about how awful it was. So it had to be something that was away from the internet for a start, and then also something that would take my mind off what was happening.
She was working in a bridal shop in Flushing, Queens, till her boyfriend kicked her out in one of those crushing scenes.
I rewatched the entire run of The Nanny, which actually holds up better than I expected. I thought this is going to be awful, but it wasn't too bad. Lots of rewatching Buffy and Angel, just day after day.
You're finding that most of the things you're nostalgic for are from the 90s. Is that about right?
Maybe that was when we were able to seek out the things that we liked independently of what the other people in our houses liked. I remember that was a time for me where I realised I could like music that wasn't the same as what my dad liked. Or like I had a boyfriend who had a car, and so we could suddenly seek out stuff that was our own stuff that we hadn't been told by someone else to like. And so maybe it's reclaiming some control over what we choose to take in or what we choose to watch or play or listen to. This is how I approached my own life and how I sort of forged a personality for myself or something, but it seems quite formative and sort of fundamental to who I am as a person, I think. It's a way of dissociating from what's happening, so it's a way of pulling oneself out of reality for a while. You know, listening to music has that quality about it where you can listen to a song that has a very strong connection with something from the past and almost be in that moment.
Another thing happened during the lockdown. Celebrities, politicians, they started posting pictures online of themselves at 20. This kind of thing happens a lot on social media. Just think of something like Throwback Thursday. But Christine Batcho from Le Moyne University says in this case, the age of 20 is very significant.
The idea of 20 is kind of not coincidental because 20 represents when you ushered in your adult self and your adult life. And yet it was a threshold. So you were still at the point in your life when all things seemed possible. Which career pathway you would take was not definite yet. You had all these opportunities, possibilities. So the idea of it being youthful but not childish, It's almost the perfect place in life. In fact, one question I've asked many of my participants in research studies over a long period of time is, if you could choose any age to be, how old would you be? And the average of all the people who have reported really hovers around 20. 20, 21, around that age. Mm. And when you ask them why, it's because they see it as the best possible place to be. You're no longer a child, so you have independence, you have freedom, but you don't have yet the heavy emotional baggage hanging over you from responsibilities or disappointments, such as, for example, failed relationships, or maybe starting a career and finding out you didn't really do well at it or didn't enjoy it. So 20 is a great time period.
Personally, something that can happen to me is I look back at my 20s, and for me it's lost opportunity. And that's can be quite a difficult thing to think about. But then I think it actually helps me to be like, okay, now look what you've got around you right now and use it. So it helps me to the present, even though it's painful.
Research today shows that actually nostalgia correlates with optimism and planning for the future, which is counterintuitive to most people. Why would looking backward help you plan forward? Well, the argument would be that, yes, you might have an occasional regret, as you have just described, but that regret could motivate you to say, I'm not going to miss another opportunity. So it kind of goes like this, and we've seen this in many people where they say, I'm looking back now and wish I had spent more quality time with my child, for example. And then they look at their next child or their third child and they say, well, I'm not going to do that again. This time I'm going to indulge and I'm going to spend even more time with this child because I've learned from my experiences in the past. People who tend to be more highly nostalgic, meaning they are more likely to become nostalgic, they're more frequently nostalgic, they tend to have better, healthier coping strategies. Mm. Whereas people who are less nostalgic, it correlates with them being more likely to use less helpful coping strategies. A less helpful strategy would be something like escapism into substance abuse, for example, or withdrawing. And that, generally speaking, is not productive for moving forward.
When you think about how we use nostalgia, that's almost like a learned skill that you get through actually coming up with the ads and wanting to, I think, put in the things that you love and you connect with as a person. And then you sort of realize that, hey, when it works really well in the world, you're like, oh my God, everyone connects with this and we all have this shared love and shared history.
Karen Ferry is a creative consultant in advertising.
A few years ago, worked on a promotion for Allen's Lollies, but we centered it all around nostalgia because when you think about Allen's Lollies, it brings you back to your childhood, but also there's this almost ritual about how you eat it. Like, you know, with the snake, you stretch it out. Mm. With the strawberries and the cream, you might eat one half and then the other. And the flavors and the tastes are all really nostalgic and they haven't really changed the recipe in any of that. So we really played with that and we mashed it up and tried to get people to, like, you know, try one of the lollies in a different shape, but, you know, connect the shape and the taste of another together and using your nostalgia to really, I guess, remind you of why you love the product, but also in a really playful way. Do you hate a green frog but love the red ones? Those mint leaves, it's like they're really polarizing, but then you sort of think about each of them and you all have your favorites and you all have memories of them. And so that's what I think is a really good example of that kind of shared connection is you feel like you're an individual because you love and hate things within the flavors, but you all love it together.
It's important to note that nostalgia works differently on different people. Tim Wildschut conducted a study looking into how nostalgia impacted Syrian refugees in Saudi Arabia.
What we found was that they benefited, by and large, from nostalgia induction, which is a little bit surprising because you would think that they've lost so much and that nostalgia would just be a reminder of the things and everything that they've lost. But the highly resilient refugees benefited from nostalgia. The less resilient refugees also benefited from nostalgia in some domains, like meaning in life and a sense of self-continuity, but they did not benefit from nostalgia in some other domains. In fact, nostalgia hurt them in the future-oriented domain, so they were less optimistic, less inspired when they experienced nostalgia. And we think that for the low resilience refugees, the ones who don't bounce back from adversity, nostalgia, although it helped them in some respects, it also gave them a sense that things will never be the same again as they were in the past. So in the sense of their future outlook, it made them more pessimistic.
When you deal with an individual who's suffering from, let's use the example of depression, one of the difficulties is that memory is to some extent mood dependent. So when you're sad, you're more likely to remember sad memories. All of our lives are a combination of the good, the bad, and the ugly. And when you're down, you tend to remember the depressing aspects of your past. When you're partying with friends, you tend to remember the good times. That's why people get together and they often share humorous memories from their past. So this mood dependency is one of the obstacles to treating depression, because you see how that cycle can trap a person in their own sadness. Nostalgia, because yes, part of it is bitter, but the other part of it is sweet, I think of as a nice bridge to sort of help them cross from all the sadness to getting to the parts that were actually sweeter. How far back a person nostalgically has to go to find the sweetness might be pretty far, but they will get there, because ultimately we were all loved unconditionally. All of us at some point in our lives had a carefree innocence before we knew that evil existed and before we knew all the bad things that could happen. And when you try to nostalgically help a person to relive that, to find it and discover it again, it can sort of break that obstacle of always being trapped in the depressing parts.
Christine Baccio, professor of psychology at Le Moyne University in Syracuse, New York, ending that story from Jennifer League. And that's all in the mind for this week. Our producer is Diane Dean, and sound engineer is Emrys Cronin. I'm Sana Kadar. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.